determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, the views of our callers as well. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the evening, this evening, Melody Cederstrom. We're going to be talking about really what's going on in the world of finance. And I think it's very interesting this weekend. I picked up a copy of the Financial Times, which is published in London. And they were talking about the European Central Bank warns of the danger of hedge funds and the threat of instability. And this is what the article said. Hedge funds have created a major risk to financial stability for which there is no obvious remedy, the European Central Bank warned yesterday in one of their bluntest official statements yet on the rapidly growing sector. In a clear hint of rising official nervousness in Europe about the multi-billion dollar industry, the European Central Bank wreaked an idiosyncratic collapse of a key hedge fund or a cluster of small funds in the same category as a possible bird flu pandemic, as the types of shocks that would trigger the fresh disruption in the financial markets. Now, I think you need to understand what they're really talking about is a total collapse. I mean, a major bird flu pandemic throughout the world would bring a financial implosion within our markets, would certainly stop industry. People would be quarantined. Nations would be quarantined. And the European Central Bank is likening failure of some of our hedge funds to that sort of affair. And you have to understand the hedge funds have billions of dollars. They're involved in the carry trade. They're borrowing money from one country at a low interest rate, say from Japan at 0%, and lending in Iceland at 10%, or even in the United States at 4%. Borrow at 0% or 1% and lend it at 3% or 10%, that's pretty good business, isn't it? But what happens if things begin getting into trouble and you have your derivative market out there and there's something like $300 trillion in derivatives out there? 350, some people say, $350 trillion. What happens if they can't pay them off because there isn't $300 trillion in the world today? My friend, who a stockbroker, lives close at hand, keeps in charge of something known as the L1 credit market debt outstanding. This information comes from the Federal Reserve System. As of December of last year, December 31st, the overall debt of America, now that's federal, state, local, house debt, all sorts of debt, was $40,694,000,000,000. 3 months later, it was $41,698,000,000,000. It had increased $1 trillion in just 3 months. Nothing like this has ever happened in all of history before. We are in real financial problems, and we're seeing this as we see the stock markets throughout the entire world beginning to tumble. Oh, here we were up 8 points today, but we're down a great deal. Gold and silver are down. Commodities are down. Everything seems to be contracting. Now, I think the gold and silver is just temporary, but we're going to have to wait and see what happens. Melody Cederstrom, what do you think about what's going on?
Well, I think you gave a very good report as to how the markets are manipulated and how they will warn people, how they need to protect themselves, and how each and every one of us will be impacted. And carry trade business is coming to an end. We've seen that.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Go ahead and pick up the story there, Melody.
The carry trade business is ending, and that's what we've seen in the markets around the world. We've seen, you know, all of the world markets get hit significantly in the past several weeks. You know, some of them are down over 30%, and it's going to carry around. But when you look at the derivatives, and you look at these hedge funds, and you look at the billions and trillions of dollars that they use, it's they can very easily move the markets and manipulate them. And I know a lot of my customers, you know, they said after the world markets were down hundreds of points over the night, and we saw the NASDAQ and the S&P, the recovering, it was all orchestrated by the working group, by the financial groups and the Federal Reserve. He seems to think that the weakness in the general stock market was in order to get the professionals to do some selling and then take that money and buy treasury paper with it. And you can see that by the inversion that is taking place by the U.S. 2-year note and the 10-year note. The 10-year should trade at a higher yield. And today the 2-year was at 5.01 and the 5-year was 4.995 and the 10-year was 5%. And so you could see the inversion. And
let me just comment that when you see this inversion, when you see the long term selling for less than the short term, this usually foreshadows a deflation or the drop in the stock market, and that is the current thing. So ordinarily, the more distant loans are higher than the short term loans. Isn't that right?
Yes. I mean, all they're doing is running up the value of the dollar. I mean, last week we saw the dollar break 84. And today, the last time I took a look at it, it was closing in on 85. They need to show the dollar's strength. And they will do anything and everything to keep it there. And you can see it all orchestrated. I do not believe in coincidences. And when we see the things happening, and when we see that the Fed and the U.S. Treasury, I mean, they control about 80% of the derivative market.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Melody. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Melody was just saying that we saw the market down 180 points today, and then just as towards the end of the day, suddenly it goes up 180 points, and it ends up being 8 points above where it started before it fell 180 points. And she's saying, and I believe it's right, this is all manipulated. You must understand that there is a committee that's authorized by government. It's perfectly legal to manipulate the stock market, because that's how you manipulate the psyche of the American people. And so they call it the working group, and they've got $100 billion or so to play with every day, and they can run the market up, they can run the market down, or when it does drop precipitously, as it has, of its own weight, then they could run it up at the end of the day as they go frantically buying stocks. If you watch very often, what will happen, all the stocks will be up, say, 3%. Why would stocks all across the board be up 3%? Because that's what they're investing, or maybe they'll all be up 1%, or you'll see almost all the stocks going up, or almost all the stocks going down. They usually go down of their own weight. They are manipulated up. Now they can manipulate the price of gold and silver. They've been doing it for a long time. In fact, there was a lawsuit that was brought by, I believe, Blanchard against one of the major gold companies for manipulating the gold market. And eventually, why an out-of-court settlement was reached. But and of course the people who were suing the large Barrick gold producers, they cannot tell you what happened, because everything is sealed. They do not want the American people to realize that the gold market has been manipulated by Barrick, working in conjunction with the Fed and some of the other people who have a vested interest in this, the central banks. They do not want the American people to realize they're manipulating the price of gold, they're manipulating the price of silver, they're manipulating the price of commodities, and they're certainly manipulating the stock market. Go ahead, Melody.
You're right. They don't want us to see what they're doing. I mean, and we mentioned this on this program. I talk about it every day, the elimination of the M3 reporting. We don't know what the real increase of the money supply is, because all we get is M2. We still get the credit, which is really the worst part, in the sense that is the most overused. So, I mean, we have a 2 to 3 week period of manipulation of markets, again, by the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, and also the Bank of England, and the central bankers. They know what's happening. Also, you have to look at the central bankers, the big players, they know the dollar is going to fall. They know it. I was just reading an article that PIMCO braces for the dollar decline. PIMCO is the world's leading bond management fund. Said it has raised currency exposure in its bond portfolio amid expectations that the dollar is about to embark on a large-scale downtrend. And we need to keep that dollar strength, and they will do all that they can to keep the strength until they no longer have control of keeping it strong. And they often mention that they want the dollar to decline. They have to let the dollar to decline, but they want it orderly. I don't believe that's possible to have a currency lowered or devalued in a timely or a controlled effort, but I believe that's what they're trying to do.
Well, I think the central banks of the world want to do this. They realize, of course, that the dollar is overvalued, and, of course, our producers, our government, believes that we can do something to limit our trade deficit by lowering the value of the dollar to make our goods cheaper, to make them more competitive on the world market. And the only trouble is that when they intentionally lower the value of the dollar, then everything we buy from overseas gets much more expensive. So everything then we're importing from other countries gets more expensive, except the Chinese have outsmarted us. They've tied their currency in large part to the American dollar. Now, recently, it's been tied to a basket of currencies, but predominantly every time the dollar drops, the Chinese currency drops, so they can continue dumping products on the United States. And, of course, undercutting our manufacturers here. So it's really a means of attacking the very stability of our economy. And who's doing it? Why, our good friends in communist China. The nation that we are financing, that we're building up, that we're lending massive amounts of money to, that we're guaranteeing loans for, that we're helping them build nuclear power plants, that they're going to use nuclear energy and uranium and but, of course, we're so concerned that Iran might be doing exactly the same thing. The only trouble is Iran has never threatened to nuke Los Angeles. Iran does not have intercontinental ballistic missiles aimed at our cities, but communist China does. And here we're doing everything we can to build up communist China. Very little going on in the world makes any logical sense unless there's another major plan going on behind the scenes. Well, certainly, Melody Cederstrom has Bob Chapin on a regular basis on her radio program. Tell me, what does Bob think about what's going on? What does he think is going to happen to the price of gold and silver? They've driven it down. It was down, 612 today from well over 740, 746 a few weeks ago. Gold seems to be almost like a free fall.
The correction that we're seeing is really abnormal in the commodity market. And they even made that announcement on CNBC today that I was a little surprised. They couldn't believe that the correction that we are seeing in the commodities, because the prices, there's no reason for the correction. Yes, it might have been overbought, and you have a lot of the nervous investors that are being shaken out of the gold market, but that's also a good thing. Worst case scenario, Bob says gold is $1,700, and that's just for gold to catch up with inflation.
But when is that going to happen? Is that going to happen? When is this downward train going to change? Does he have any thoughts on that?
The correction has to run its course. And
I think that's a good answer.
We don't know.
We don't know where
the bottom can be. We're still in a bull market. And it doesn't matter where it goes. He doesn't believe it'll go past 425. We almost ended the first phase of the bull market. When we reached 730, it was on its way to 850. And market obviously had been overbought, and we had a correction, and we had had a very large one.
I don't think it's simply a matter of normal buying pressures.
No.
Believe this is manipulated. I believe Goldman Sachs is in the market shorting both gold and silver. I remember now, of course, we have a new Secretary of the Treasury, and where did he come from?
Yep,
Why, Goldman Sachs,
Sachs,
of course. And of course, these people then are part and parcel of these groups that manipulate the gold market. Why do they want to manipulate the gold market? Because they do not want the price of gold to go up, so the people would suspect that it has intrinsic value. They want you to deal with their paper money that is backed by absolutely nothing. And, Chris, we are in a total fiat money system, as I pointed out at the very beginning of the program. The debt of the United States increased $1 trillion in the last 3 months. This is the L1 credit market debt outstanding. And if any of you would like to see copies of that, we'd be glad to send it to you. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We have the figures as of the end of last year, in our which goes to the $40 trillion, $40,600,000,000,000. That's in our financial tsunami the syllabus, and if you get the financial tsunami syllabus, why, we'll put these figures in as well, so you can update what is already there, and you can begin to understand there's this massive increase in credit and in debt. And of course, they have to put this to an end, either that or the whole economic system comes tumbling down. $1 trillion increase in 3 months. Ladies and gentlemen, it took 200 years for the United States to accumulate a debt of $1 trillion. And we increased $1 trillion in 3 months between January and the end of March. We are in real trouble. The average individual doesn't even know how to read these figures or what they mean, but we're really beginning to see the whole world begin to implode. We're beginning to see certainly the central banks throughout the world beginning cutting back on the availability of money and credit, because if they do not, all of the countries of the world are going to lose the value of the currencies.
Well, you know, there's also a possibility that, I mean, you have Russia and the Middle East that look for outlets for their petrodollars. You have the Chinese attempt to diversify their massive dollar reserves. You have India that continues to prolong their purchasing of gold. And now that you have the dollar strengthening a little bit and you've had this major correction in gold, what a great time for them to get rid of more of their dollars and to buy gold. So it's another reason why I believe this correction is going to be short-lived.
And I think that, of course, China is trying to strengthen their currency. They've got a lot of paper money that is backed by nothing but American dollars, that is backed by absolutely nothing. And, of course, we've actually blocked them from buying things here in the United States, like Unocal and certain other corporations they've wanted to buy. And so they're talking about, of course, increasing their gold holdings. Russia is exactly the same thing. Russia is talking about setting up a BRAUS, in other words, some sort of a market for selling their oil and their natural gas, and it will be in rubles and in gold. Iran is talking about doing the similar thing. In fact, it's to be later this month. It was to have been earlier, and then it was put off temporarily, but Iran is talking about selling their products in euros, and all of these things are attacks on the stability of the American dollar. The average American really doesn't understand. We're on the edge of a financial precipice, and you're certainly not going to hear this from Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or on CNBC. So we're going to be back here in just a moment with Melody Cederstrom and talking about what's going on. But we will tell you that an article recently in Moody's pointed out that the new accounting requirements by the government are going to show that Goodyear, Tire, Lucent, General Motors, and Ford, their net value is far less than the stockholders' value. In other words, stockholders have absolutely no equity at all in any of those corporations. When you take into account what they owe for pensions, they don't have the money to pay it. Well, Melody, why don't you just pick up there?
I just wanted to make a comment as far as gold being in the bull market. I believe most of the listeners probably heard of Jimmy Rogers. He was a partner of George Soros in one of the earliest and most successful hedge funds, the Quantum Fund. But he was looking at the previous bull market in commodities, and the shortest one lasted 15 years. And the longest one has lasted 23 years. So this one, we just got started. And gold is a little bit different than what we saw in the dot-com stocks. I mean, you can create a dot-com company in about 20 minutes. But it takes a long time to get a copper mine up, a gold mine up. And so the prices of copper, the prices of the commodities, the prices of gold, silver, the prices are not going to be going down because it's so difficult to get that product on the market. And so same way with oil and refining of the oil. The demand is there. The supply is low. Silver is 75% below its all-time high. And after the last 2 weeks, it's 20%. It's cheaper still. And so these prices and today's prices, if they were adjusted for inflation, gold, silver is still very, very cheap.
Well, I think that basically what we're going to see is a continued increase in the price of basic commodities. And a lot of this is not necessarily even the price of the commodities going up. It's the value of the dollar going down. And really, one of the best observers out there I know of is a fellow named the name escapes me now. Of course, he's been writing certainly the Dow Jones. He writes the Dow Theory Letter.
Richard Russell.
And Richard Russell says that we are on the edge of the greatest gold market of all time. You know, and he says the stock market is going to fall. The price of gold is going to rise and eventually going to cross. He anticipates it may be several months before the current decrease in the price of gold and silver is played out and before it starts to go back up again. But he doesn't seem to have any question at all as far as the fact it is going to go up again. He tells people not to speculate, to take a position, to hold it, and just to watch it. And Richard Russell has been around for a long period of time. And, of course, I think he's been through this before. He doesn't think you should be playing in the stock market. He doesn't think you should be trying to play any of the commodity markets. Take your position and hold it. And he believes that we're going to see some of the most amazing things we've ever seen within the next couple of years.
People have a tendency to get caught up in the emotional roller coaster that they see when they're holding, gold, silver, if they're holding gold stocks. And he's absolutely correct. You just need to take a position and hold it. And if anything, when you have these corrections and you have these pullbacks, you should be looking in your checking account and you should be adding to your portfolios, because as much as it falls, it just means it's going to recapture and continue to go higher. It's going to be like a rubber band being pulled back and letting go. And same way, if you're purchasing and you bought numismatic coins, the same thing. If you see any type of corrections, you should continue to purchase and adjust your portfolios, and because they'll just recapture what they lost in addition to, because we're in the bull market.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be right back here in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Melody Cederstrom, and our telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And, of course, Melody does support Radio Liberty, and we certainly believe she does a good job for the people who call in. And we've had all sorts of good reports from people who have talked to her and have followed her advice. But I think that these are strange times. I don't think the average person has any idea of the history of the markets, because what we're seeing today in many ways is like deja vu all over again. We saw it in 1980. We saw it back in 1930s. That was 50 years, and here we are almost 50 years again when we're beginning to see this great market really beginning to explode before our very eyes. And, of course, we're beginning to see what's happening throughout the world as central banks are beginning to take money and credit out of circulation. Why? Because they have to. If they do not, cut back on the availability of money, they destroy the value of their currency. And the purpose of a central bank is to maintain a stable currency, because without a stable currency, you do not have a stable society. So at least many of the central banks, with the exclusion, of course, of ours, are beginning to try to stabilize their currency. This is why Japan has been in a recession for 16 years. Why? because they're trying to stabilize their currency, and now they're trying to stimulate the economy again, and they're having a terrible time really getting this thing going. But certainly people throughout in other countries have been through these roller coasters before and seen the value of their currency totally destroyed. That's why in the European countries, why they are doing everything they can to prevent runaway inflation. And here in the United States, we're doing everything we can to encourage runaway inflation. Certainly, Alan Greenspan was told that he should regulate the hedge funds. He should regulate the carry trade. He should regulate the derivatives. And instead of doing what was necessary to prevent this explosion of credit, Alan Greenspan absolutely refused. Alan Greenspan stimulated the first great stock market bubble. He stimulated the housing bubble by telling people to take adjustable rate mortgages. Why would you have people who should never be allowed to buy a house because they don't have adequate money to make up their payments and who will eventually lose their homes and all of their equity and investment? Why would he encourage them to participate in a totally unsound housing market bubble? And maybe one day we'll know the answer to that, but we do know that here in the United States, contrary to what they're doing throughout the rest of the world, they've done everything wrong. So go ahead, Melody.
When people look at gold correcting, the fundamentals are all there. It's all about what was done in the past, the bubbles that have been created, the debt. There isn't one of those that's being addressed. That's changing. The situation is on a path of deterioration. And so when we see these corrections, when we see gold drop, it isn't because things are getting better. It's a temporary manipulation. And people can't get caught up in the roller coaster emotions of gold and silver going down, correcting, and you hear so many different opinions out there, particularly with the internet and all the listeners out there. They can go get on these different gold websites and read, just tons of articles, and everyone has an opinion, and you know, they begin to change their thoughts, and you have these news writers who tell people that they should be getting out of the gold market, and just like there were so many newsletters that told people to get out at 5:10 and 5:20. And you know what? These newsletter writers, they really don't understand what the dynamics are and how this whole system works and why gold is still a very important part in the world and why they need to suppress gold in relation to the different currencies. Governments know. You know, and that's why you have Russia and India and China and Iran and Argentina and, you know, all these central banks that want to increase their reserves of gold, because they understand what's going to happen. They understand that the dollars that they're holding is going to be decreasing in value. So they're hedging their bets. They're hedging their holdings. And they're going to continue to eliminate their dollars. And we talked briefly about Russia and there, that was supposed to start today. I'm not sure. I hadn't had a chance to find out what the reports on that were as far as opening their markets on the trading the oil and gold and rubles. And but everything is orchestrated. Everything is planned, even from us giving Iran all those items in which they should come to an agreement with us to, as far as I'm concerned, the death of the Iraqi guys, Kawi, it's all planned and orchestrated. They're playing out their agenda.
Hold on, we'll be back in just a moment here with Melody. We'd love to hear from you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Melody Cederstrom, and Melody was simply saying that she felt that in many respects everything was being played out, and it's almost like there's a master script. I really feel that if you look at things and you see things unfolding, there is a master script. There are people who've been planning for generations to take us into World War III. There are people who have been planning for generations to destroy the financial stability of the United States and shift the leadership of the world from the United States to China and to India. And you say, well, why would anybody want to do that? Well, because there are people who have a different dream, a different grasp of the world, who have no loyalty to the United States, and they work through certain organizations that have an internationalist bent, and their objective is not to continue America's leadership, but to create a new world order and a new world religion. And so as you begin seeing all these things unfolding today, and a lot of things don't make sense. I mean, why should we be demanding that Iran go ahead and do what we say as far as suspending their efforts to develop nuclear weapons? Because we say they shouldn't have them when we don't object to India having nuclear weapons, and they've developed them, and you know, in contrast to the commitment not to develop nuclear weapons, and Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and China has nuclear weapons, and Israel has nuclear weapons, and Russia has nuclear weapons. Why shouldn't Iran have nuclear weapons? So you have to understand that nothing is as it appears to be. We're making impossible demands on Iran, and if Iran holds its position and we do have an attack on Iran, believe me, we will inflame the entire Islamic world, and it doesn't make any sense that we would be doing this thing. And yet we're doing it. So if you have any questions or comments, you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. 464-8295. And what you need to understand is that, you know, in uncertain times, people always want to turn to something that has intrinsic value. And especially when we see the massive explosion of debt here in the United States, and the new L1 figures, show that the debt, now that's a combined state, national, local, and personal debt, has increased $1 trillion in the last 3 months. $1 trillion. If you'd like to see those big Z figures, well, we'll make them available to you. But you must understand that the whole financial infrastructure of America is beginning to shake today. The great earthquake is about to strike. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Melody Cederstrom. And Melody, would you like to tell our listeners how they could get in touch with you and your website, your telephone number, and of course, what that happened if they did get in touch with you?
Well, they can go to my website, which is, and it's a long one, so sharpen your pencils. It's Discount Gold and with and spelled out, Discount Gold and Silver Trading.net. That is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. And for those who call for information, if you go to the website, if you have computer access, a lot of the information that I send out is what you will find on the website. We designed the website a little bit differently to give you an idea about what the company is about. We don't post prices. We don't post different coins or what you should buy. We show pictures. But I believe each person has their own investment objective, and it's my job to tell you what the different coins are available and to help you determine what your investment objective is. So you can call me at 1-800-375-4188, and that number is 1-800-375-4188. I truly do not believe that there's a one coin fits all. So often, you'll find different people trying to sell everyone the same coin or the same portfolio. And I just, I believe in diversifying, and I believe, based on the individual, what you're planning to invest, you know, there might be a particular coin that would better suit you and stretch your dollar the furthest. And because ultimately you want to own gold, you want to purchase as much gold as you can with your dollars, because you work hard for those dollars. And we believe in getting you a great product at a great price. So you can call us at 1-800-375-4188.
All right, fine. And certainly, now you, of course, then will give people suggestions of what you think ought to be done. What do you think about investing in silver at this time? And certainly, I think silver is really going to run up. It's going to do very well financially. But is silver as good an investment as gold, or should be invested in both gold and silver?
Well, I believe you need to have both gold and silver. I believe you should be about 80% gold and 20% silver. And, of course, that changes, again, with each individual based on your investment objective. I have customers that are 100% invested in silver. I have customers who do the 80-20, and then I have other customers who are totally invested in gold. I believe that we've had this correction in gold. We know where gold is going to go. I mean, $1,700 is pretty much minimum, worst-case scenario. Purchase your gold now while it's still affordable. But again, you want to diversify and pick up both gold and silver, again, based on your investment objectives. Again, diversification, we've talked about that before, is the best way to go. Silver, there's a lot of products that you can purchase in the silver area. I believe the most cost-effective is the 90% bags. These are the old quarters, dimes, and 50-cent pieces that were made out of silver. And I had someone call me today, and they wanted to know what uncirculated Kennedy half dollars were running for. And I told her, I said, well, you may as well just buy regular VG Plus bags. Those are very good plus condition coin bags. Because in those bags, you will receive Kennedy halves. And those Kennedy halves were hardly ever in circulation. So most of the coins that you get if you purchase the 50-cent pieces, most of them will look like they're uncirculated. And so many times, that's what you'll get when you buy circulated coins, because you can't tell the difference. I mean, there's so little differences between what you find in a VG Plus bag and when you buy circulated. But you'll pay about $10 more per coin for an uncirculated 50-cent piece.
Well, now, are those 90% silver, or are they the 40% silver?
Those are 90% silver. The 40% Kennedy halves were minted from 65 to 69, and those were, they continued the 50-cent piece during that time just to honor President Kennedy, and then after 69, they stopped at the silver mintage totally. But the 90% bags were up and including 64.
I think what people have to understand is they wanted to take anything of value from backing our currency. That's what it was. First of all, it was 90% silver, and then it was 40% silver, and then one day we woke up and there was no silver in our currency at all, in our coinage. And the same thing has happened with our dollars. If you looked at the notation on the currency up until 1964-5, I guess it was, it said this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and is redeemable in lawful money at any branch of the United States Treasury or at any branch of the Federal Reserve System. And then one day we looked at our currency and it said, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. And that's all it said. In other words, we suddenly had gone into a fiat money system. Nobody understood what had happened. Nobody understood the significance of what was happening. But of course, 15 years later, while we were in a total economic crash situation, the inflation rate was 19%. Why? Because there was nothing behind our currency. And had it not been for Paul Volcker, who actually increased interest rates to 22% or 22%, the whole currency, the foundation of our currency of the United States and the whole world would have collapsed at that time. Most people don't understand how close we came to a collapse at that time. The question is, what are we going to do now? All the rabbits have been removed from the hat, and of course the hat's got a great big hole in it. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. If you have a question, agree or disagree, well, that's what talk radio is all about. But I think that we are on the edge of something very dramatic. When the market goes down 180 points in one day, and then at the end of the day, suddenly the market comes back again, you know somebody's manipulating that market. Wouldn't you agree?
I absolutely would agree. And, you know, like I mentioned earlier, it's like here you have the world markets you know, falling 30%. You have our market that goes down 180 and reverses, you know, and you still have the U.S. dollar gaining strength. I mean, I can't figure out why people couldn't see the simple picture how things are manipulated. And I know I have customers who, you know, don't believe things are being manipulated to the extent that they are, but there is no other rational explanation for them. So I say, well, forget about the manipulation and just look at the facts. You know, forget about Iran, whatever happens with Iran, whatever happens to Iraq or any place else, the fundamentals right here in this country is dire, and it will have an impact on the dollar. The dollar is going down, just like you mentioned. They have to have it. Devalue. It has to lose value, but it will lose it when they're ready for it to lose it, and they will control it, you know, as long as they can. And I'm in agreement with you. I do believe there is a master script, a master plan, and they are following it. And it surprised the heck out of me when the U.S. came to Iran to give them everything that we gave them. And so it just goes to show how serious and how close we possibly really were to a major situation. And who knows if that what we agreed to give them has really diffused the situation.
Well, of course, what is the Iranian response to our demands?
Well, they're saying they're still going to continue with the enrichment.
Well, of course, our leaders can say, look, we've done everything we possibly could.
Yep.
Look how generous we were. And they wouldn't accept what we wanted, so, well, just nothing else. We have no alternative. They forced our hand. Even if the United Nations will not back us, we will have to work by ourselves to preserve the stability of the Middle East by launching a preemptive strike on the wicked President Ahmadinejad of Iran. And of course, it's all totally unnecessary. People have forgotten how the radical Islamic clerics gain control of Iran. And, of course, the CIA, back in 1979, plotted to undercut the Shah of Iran and bring the Ayatollah Khomeini to power in 1979. That didn't make sense. But if you understand, we're working on a script. There is a timetable. They want a war in the Middle East. Then it makes a lot of sense in the year 2006. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the next week or two. Condoleezza Rice has said, we will not wait months. We will wait a few weeks. But, of course, if they have not agreed to our demands at that time, then we'll take the next step. What is the next step? Well, we can't very well put sanctions onto Iran because I don't believe that either Russia or China go along with it. So then what's the alternative? How are we going to force them to do what we want? How are we going to force them to stop, enriching uranium? Well, if they won't do it on their own, maybe we're just going to have to stop those plants from functioning. And how do you do that? Why, with a limited attack. Of course, we're not going to have a major attack, just a little attack. We'll just kill a few people, maybe a few thousand or a few tens of thousands. But after all, isn't that better than letting them develop nuclear weapons and threaten the stability of the world? And I fear very much that if we do launch a limited attack on Iran, there is no such thing as a limited war. It's being a little bit pregnant. And I fear we're going to inflame the entire Muslim population of the world against the United States.
Well, to me, I think it would be a matter of whether Russia or China has enough impact on Iran to say, you know, why don't you quit it for a while or something like that. I don't know if Iran, because they're getting all these contracts with both China and they're getting items from Russia also, so they might back down, you know, if they put enough pressure on Iran. But then we're just talking about agreements between Iran and the U.S. You know, we still have Israel that could, like you said, the U.S. could simply say, well, you know, we tried to work this out with you and everything. And if an agreement is made, you know, no one says that Israel can't go in there and do something.
And I think what everybody has missed is the point that I'm sure the Russians and the Chinese would love to fight to the last American in the Middle East. would love to have America involved in a war with Iran, and they don't care how many Iranians are killed. They don't care how many of our troops are killed or how much damage is done to our position as far as our Navy over there, which is quite vulnerable, or how many Jews get killed in Israel. They're quite willing to fight to the last American soldiers, just exactly as they did, you know, in Korea. And, of course, the Russians wanted us in that no-win war in Korea, and we obliged. And they wanted us in a no-win war in Vietnam, and we obliged. And they want us in a no-win war because there's no way we can win a war with Iran. We can't invade. All we can do is attack militarily. And in the process, I really fear what's going to happen as far as the rest of the world is concerned. Will this be the economic crisis that begins to bring the dollar down and, of course, begins to certainly break the back of our stock market? I don't know. We're just going to have to watch and see. But I feel we're living in very, very dangerous times. Tell me, Melody, what's happening as far as your customers? Are more people buying? Are they selling? Are they sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what's happening with this correction?
Well, I think they're sitting on the sidelines. We have, people that were, it was funny when it reached the price today, $610, that seemed to be a magic number. So, and I thought that was fairly interesting. I didn't see it at $620 or, $625. When spot gold hit $610, there was a definite pickup in interest, and so perhaps $610 could be the bottom. I don't know, but most of my customers, their gold bugs. They continue to buy. They continue to add to their portfolios, and every time we have a dip, they buy. So you still have those customers who truly understand the dynamics of the gold market and what is happening in this country and to our dollar policy and our economy. And they realize that when the dollar begins to fall, they lose their purchasing power. They know that holding money in CDs, they're losing. They're losing value. They're losing their purchasing power. So they take their cash, and they don't keep it. They put it into gold, and they hold it. When we saw gold approaching 730, it was interesting because I had buyers. It was almost the beginning. It seemed like it was that the beginning of people. They just wanted it, they just wanted it, and it was short lived, but it just proved that gold will have to reach 8850 for that general populace to come in to really propel it to the higher limits in which we're expecting. So it's been interesting.
Well, I think that one thing I've learned over a period of years and having made many mistakes is that when things go up, they always go up higher than you anticipate. Mm-hmm. When things fall, they always fall farther than you anticipate and more rapidly. So we're just going to have to wait and see. I think that this is really a very, very exciting time. And, I hope that many of our listeners out there are beginning to make preparations. And let me just mention that we have a great talk. It's called The Financial Tsunami. And it's available either on VHS or DVD. It comes with a syllabus, and if you request, we'll give you the latest Z figures. You specifically ask for them if you'd like, and we'll be glad to provide them. They just came out today, showing that within the last 3 months, the debt, overall debt in the Americas, United States has increased $1 trillion. I think it's $1 trillion, $2 billion, but $1 trillion in 3 months. That is a phenomenal figure, but you're not going to hear that elsewhere. So anyway, we're just sort of running out of time. The hour has just sort of flown by here, Melody. So basically, does Bob Chapman have any predictions, or is just saying we're going to have to sit and watch and wait and see what happens?
Well, we're going to have to wait and let the correction play itself out. But again, we have, for gold to catch up with just inflation, you're going to be seeing 1700. So, you can't lose hope. And, we don't know where the bottom might be. But again, I think the 610 was interesting to see an additional interest in purchasing. And people have a tendency to become complacent, and then they procrastinate, and they shouldn't do that. They need to make plans. If you were thinking about making plans when gold was at 700 and you thought, well, gee, I'm going to wait now and see what happens, you shouldn't do it. But it's so easy to fall into that mindset. The next thing you know, gold could turn around very quickly.
No, we're just going to have to wait for a little while and see what happens. And you want to see what happens. I mean, it's going to hit a bottom. It's going to bounce off the bottom. It's going to come back again. But wait till it bounces a couple of times before you move. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Melody Cederstrom, and we've got Tom calling us from Chicago. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Real good, Dr. Stan. Always an interesting program. I was one of those people that got in on May 1st and May 7th and went into, instead of American Church Trust, we went in with Fidelity, their Select Gold, and we have taken about a $10,000 hit in a very short period of time.
Well, Tom, don't panic. Just sit tight.
Well, we really should have gone into physical gold. And physical gold, the only way you could get that is in the American Trust holdings, or buy it physically and put it in a safe place.
Well, of course, there's the exchange-traded fund. Is that what you're speaking of?
Right, exactly. That's the only one that you could hold a 401 with being able to hold physical gold on deposit.
All right, fine. Do you have any thoughts at all for Tom there? Tom, of course, is an old friend, and he is apparently, they've taken a tremendous hit. What would you tell him, Melody?
Well, I appreciate Tom calling and telling folks that they need to take the possession of their gold. And, you know, I'm not quite sure how the Fidelity gold works, but, you know, gold will come back. But it's so important to take possession. And for those of you who have, you know, 401s in your workplace and they don't allow you to purchase gold in them, you might want to check into the IRAs in which you can place gold. In fact, you can place gold, silver, platinum, or palladium. So you can get a diversified portfolio because it's so important to have that gold. And if you don't want to keep it in the funds or the American Church Trust, bite the bullet, take your penalty, pay your taxes, and take physical possession and keep your gold right by your side.
All right, fine. Anything else you wanted to say there, Tom, before we let you go?
I just want you to know that we, years ago, when it was down to 225 to 250, we bought a lot of it. So we're doing fine. We just took a little hit in this area, but I'll tell the people, I think 580 or 590 is probably the way to really grab some physical gold.
Amen to that. Well, thanks very much, Tom. I think we just have to wait and watch and see, and none of us can be prophetic on it. Only one thing, and that is that there's the old golden rule, and that is he who has the gold rules, and that is what the other side wants. They don't want us to have it. They want it all for themselves. Good night. God bless.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, and we're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up the program here with Melody. Well, Melody, let's go ahead and get your telephone number and your website out one more time before we let you go.
The website is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net, discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. And the phone number is 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188.
God bless, and thanks so much. We'll talk to you later.
God bless you too, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Good night now.
Good night. And that was Melody Cederstrom, and we're simply talking about what's been going on in the financial markets and the exciting times, and we're just going to have to watch and wait and see. Remember, I am not a financial advisor. I'm simply an old fellow who's made an awful lot of mistakes through the years, and I can tell you that we are entering very, very difficult times. We have a lot of smart people. We did a wonderful interview with Jim Poplava the other day, who I think knows an awful lot about what's going on, and we'll try to bring you the wisdom of people like Richard Russell and certainly our good friends Bob Chapman and others, and you're going to have to decide what's going on. But the one thing that I can tell you is we are moving into a financial tsunami, a perfect financial storm. Everything is in place, and of course the people on the other side know what's happening, because of course they are positioning themselves to survive. They just don't want you to understand or position yourself, because in times like this, most people lose everything they have. If you've not yet seen our DVD or VHS, The Financial Tsunami, and read the syllabus, you need to do that. And then, of course, if you'd like, you can simply ask for the latest Z figures, and we'll be glad to get them for you. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We have an excellent pamphlet. It's called The History of Money. It's rather inexpensive, but it basically gives you the whole background of not only the history of money, but the spiritual forces behind this. And we certainly quote from Professor Quigley, who tells you how the central banks of the world work together in concert to create a world feudalistic system under their control, and how the central banks control their respective governments by controlling of the monetary level, by controlling interest rates, by controlling the volume and availability of funds. So the central banks really run the government. The government doesn't control the central banks. The Federal Reserve System is not a government agency. It's a privately owned central bank that gives you the impression it's government control, but it really doesn't. It is the bankers that control the Federal Reserve, not the Federal Reserve that controls. I should say that it is the bankers that control the Federal Reserve, not the government or Congress or anybody else. And if you'd like, of course, to get the book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, by Anthony Sutton, Professor Anthony Sutton, a personal friend. If you would like to get Ed Griffin's wonderful book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, you need to get these. You need to read them now. And you need, of course, to begin to prepare for the coming financial tsunami. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, our website, www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. Pray for revival, because if we don't have revival, we're going to lose America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Hill. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line certainly one of my favorite guests, and I hope he's one of yours as well, Bill Federer. Bill, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Dr. Stan.
And, of course, you've been giving some talks back there in Washington, D.C. on a number of interesting issues, and you were going to share one with us tonight. I think isn't the one about NAFTA and, of course, the unintended consequences of that. So I'm going to let you pick up the story, because you're one of the few people that can carry the whole program. You don't even need me.
Oh, well, you're so kind. It's always an honor to be with you. Yeah, I was in Washington, D.C. For the Statesmanship Institute. George Roller is the head of it, and of course it's part of the ministry that Dr. D. James Kennedy has out of Florida. But we had a meeting in the White House for congressional staffers. They even had some staff there from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Pentagon. But my topic was the history of the United States with Mexico. And it's just a fascinating story, timeline, and I went back to the very beginning. 250 to 900 A.D. is when there was the Mayan Empire there in the Yucatan part of Mexico. When that diminished in 1325 A.D. to 1521 was the Aztec Empire, and the Aztecs, another name for them was the Mexica, or that's where we get the name Mexico from. But one of the things that is important to see how history weaves together is the Muslims in Europe finally conquered Constantinople in 1452, and this cut off all the land routes to India and China from Western Europe. So the Western Europeans were trying to find an alternative route to get to India and China, and so Columbus sailed west, and that's when he discovered the New World. Didn't realize he discovered it, but he did. And a couple things he set in motion, unfortunately, was the encomiendo system, where the Columbus and his brother were Italian, and on the second voyage, Columbus brought 2,000 Spaniards over, and they were mostly the get-rich-quick kind, and when they didn't get rich quick, they began to even have a revolt against Columbus, and Columbus gave in by allowing them to each have a plot of land, and any Indians that just happened to be on that land, they were supposed to take care of, sort of like wards of the state. Well, the Spanish version of taking care of was making slaves of them. And this began what went on through Latin America for hundreds of years, where there was a class society, where the Spaniards were on top, and then the Spanish Indian mix was next, and then the Indians were underneath. And in 1519 is when Cortez sailed to Mexico and landed at Veracruz, which is Spanish for True Cross, and he burnt his ship, so his sailors, his soldiers realized that they couldn't turn back, and so he decided we have to conquer Mexico City, the Aztec Empire, or die. And by 1521, they indeed did conquer Mexico City. Fascinating, couple little pieces of the story.
All right, will you hang on to that story for just a minute here as we just prepare to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back with William Federer. Bill, pick up the story from there.
Well, Cortez, some of the things in the story are so amazing. there were two priests in the early 1500s who had been shipwrecked. Well, actually, the Spanish ships were shipwrecked, and the two priests were the only ones who survived. And they lived with the Indians, and when Cortez decided to land there, one of them canoed out to Cozumel, the island, and met Cortez and was able to speak the Indian language. And then Cortez picked up a woman slave who happened to speak the Aztec language. So Cortez would speak Spanish to Juan de Aquila, who was the the one Spanish priest. Anyway, he would speak in the Indian tongue to this girl, and then this girl would speak in the Aztec language. And anyway, she showed them how to get to Mexico City. Teotihuacan was the name of Mexico City. And when they were traveling, the other tribes that had been oppressed by the Aztecs joined with Cortez against the Aztecs. The Aztecs had an empire that stretched from ocean to ocean, millions of people, and their religion required them to have human sacrifice to keep the sun burning, if you can believe that. And so they had over 300 temples across the nation, and over 20,000 people a year were sacrificed. When they dedicated their big temple in Mexico City, it's reported that over 80,000 people were sacrificed. When Cortez's men entered Mexico City, they commented about seeing all the, you know, piles of human bones and human skulls and very gory situation. Well, evidently these tribes around Mexico, around the Aztecs, were taken captive, and they were the ones that had to supply the people that were getting killed. And so they were more than happy to help Cortez in overthrowing the Aztecs. And a couple interesting parts of the story. Before the Spaniards had even come to the New World, the Aztecs began to have, they were very superstitious. Montezuma was the leader, and he was very superstitious.
Oh, you're going to have to hold out there for just a moment. We'll be right back as we bring our stations on board here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Bill Federer. He's talking about, of course, when Cortez invaded Mexico. And, of course, Cortez had actually had a fleet of ships, and he burned those ships and told his men that they would either have to conquer Mexico City or die. And, of course, the Spanish had, and Cortez had the advantage because the Aztecs were ruthless. They used to have mass sacrifices, and they had, of course, enslaved all the surrounding tribes. So when Cortez is advancing on Mexico, why, all the surrounding tribes who were not Aztec joined together with him, and here he is, a very, very small band of Spaniards, and yet they are able to contact to actually, defeat Montezuma and this powerful Aztec army, and really take over control of the Aztec civilization. So pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, several years before the Spaniards came to the New World, they had omens, for example, comets in the sky. At one point, the lake that the city was built on began bubbling because it was in a volcano, they would have stories of voices of ladies screaming in the night, and one was Montezuma's sister had fallen into a coma. They thought she had died, and in the process of the burial ceremony, she wakes up and she has this frightful vision that there were men coming from the east on ships with big sails with crosses on them, and the men had crosses on their forehead, and that's why Montezuma had one of his men steal a helmet from Cortez's soldiers, and sure enough, there was a cross on the helmet. So he was very superstitious, and as Cortez got closer and closer, he wasn't sure if this was an enemy that he had to defend against, or if this was a god, their god Quetzalcoatl, who they thought would come back, who was you know, lived hundreds of years before and died and supposedly threw himself into the volcano, and he was supposed to return and end the human sacrifice, and so they thought this might be him. But so Montezuma opens the door, lets Cortez in, and treats him like a dignitary, and even has a royal dinner. And during the course of it, the soldiers realize that they were in the middle of this potentially enemy city with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that could kill him, and they respond by putting Montezuma under house arrest. And then Cortez gets word that some other Spaniards have landed and they are going to try to fight him, so he leaves his second-in-command in charge and goes out to fight those people. Meanwhile, the Indians in Mexico City have a ceremony that the Spanish second-in-command misinterpreted and thought they were doing a revolt, and so he and his men go out there and kill a whole bunch of them with their swords, and that leads to a revolt. So now they're barricaded into the palace mansions there, and meanwhile, Cortez is out fighting these other Spaniards. Part of the story is that amongst them was a black slave who had smallpox, and he came in contact with one of Cortez's men. One of Cortez's men went back after they win. Cortez and his men go back into Mexico City. They rescue the ones that are captive. Montezuma dies, so they try to flee the city. They have to fight their way out, and the one guy that had smallpox ended up dying. Am I still with you, Dr. Stan?
Yeah, you're right. Okay. I'm hanging on every word you're saying, Bill.
heard a little fuzz on the line.
All right, go right ahead.
But it's interesting, the story of Cortez's men leaving the city, some of the soldiers had put so much gold in their pockets that it slowed them down, and the island of Mexico City had three causeways to get back to land, and when the Indians tried to stop them, some of the bridges were broken, and so they had to swim, and these guys that were weighed down with gold couldn't swim, and so they sank. So there's a little story there on trying to take too much of the gold with you. But Cortez's men finally escape from the city, and then they go back to Veracruz to rest for a year before redoing their attack. And when they get back, August 21st of 1521, Cortez storms the city, only to find that they had died from smallpox. One of the citizens of Tenochtitlan wrote, "A great many died from the plague, and many others died of hunger. They could not get up to search for food. Everyone else was too sick to care for them. They starved to death in their own beds." And Cortez's chronicler, who was one of his soldiers, was Bernal Diaz, and he wrote, "I solemnly swear that all the houses and stockades in the lake were full of heads and corpses. It was the same in the streets and in the courts. We could not walk without treading on bodies and the heads of dead Indians. I've read about the destruction of Jerusalem, but I do not think that mortality was greater than here in Mexico. Indeed, the stench was so bad that no one could endure it, and even Cortez was ill from the odors which assailed his nostrils." And so this was millions of Indians died because of the smallpox and then the other diseases that were brought from the old world to the new world. Yes, there were bad treatment of the Indians by the Spaniards, that first generation especially, but the majority of them died through the diseases. So we talk about germ warfare today and the dangers of it. That was definitely the case back then. In 1527, finally smallpox was taken by Indian messengers to the Incan Empire and wiped them out, so that when Pizarro finally came to the Incas and in the Andes down in South America, that great empire was pretty well wiped out before Pizarro even got there. Anyway, the Mexicans, the Spaniards began to destroy the pagan temples and build Catholic churches, and but there was an uprising that was in the works. The Spaniards began to set up their encomiendo system, where they would divide up the land, and the Spanish soldiers would get to rule the Mexican Indians that were on the land that they had. And when a revolt almost took place, the Archbishop Juan de Zumraga in Mexico City, this was 10 years after Cortez, there's the story of Juan Diego and the Our Lady of Guadalupe, where he supposedly was walking toward Mexico City, and on the hill where the Tenantzin, who was the mother goddess of the Aztecs, where her temple used to be, but it was torn down. But on that hill, Juan Diego had a vision of the Virgin Mary saying, build a church to me here. And he goes, and long story short, you know, visits the archbishop and tells him, and he doesn't believe it, and he doesn't believe it, and tells him again and again. Finally, he rolls up some rare roses in his tilma, his jacket, and when he gets to the archbishop, the story is that he let down his poncho, and the roses fell, and on his poncho was the painting of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Now, that's the story, and but nevertheless, when the Indians saw this painting, they saw the was sort of a cross between their mother goddess and Mary from the Christian religion, and they took this as a sign that it was okay for them to convert to Christianity. And so 15 million Indians converted to Catholicism in just a few years period. It's the largest single mass conversion in the history of mankind. The churches write about how they would have lines of tens of thousands of them coming in, and they would just, you know, pour water on the head as they walked past the line, and you know, the different priests would talk about baptizing, you know, 10,000 people a day here and 14,000 people a day there. Now, they didn't get training that fast, and so a lot of them did have this syncretism where they would mix in their pagan practices along with, you know, the Catholic beliefs. But nevertheless, there was no uprising of the Aztecs. But from that point on, up until today, Mexico has been Catholic. And even today, there's the poll is 89% of the population of Mexico is Catholic. And so this is part of the equation that enters the politics in a later time. Mexico ends up settling into the rich and the poor. You had the rich Spaniards, who were the ruling class, you had the mestizos, who were the Spanish-Indian mix, and then the Indians, who were at the bottom of the ladder, and they were the ones that worked on the farms and were the peasants. And there wasn't any upward mobility, whereas in America, there were the entrepreneurship and the middle class that settled it. It wasn't the monarchs that settled America. It was those that fled Europe. And then also, America was founded largely by lots of different Protestant denominations who at first didn't get along with each other, and so they had to learn how to tolerate each other, but they kept each other in check. But the First Amendment, when our government was formed, was simply to prevent one Christian, and by, at that time they meant Protestant Christian denomination, from becoming the national denomination. Where they didn't have that in Mexico, and so it was just one single denomination, the Catholic denomination, so there were the class society of the rich and the poor. When Napoleon, so we'll fast forward from Cortez all the way up through the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, all the way up to 1810, and Napoleon invaded Spain and got rid of the king and put his brother on as the emperor of Spain. So this French guy was the emperor. And so that's when Mexico decided to rebel against Spain, started by a priest named Miguel Hidalgo. He's known as the father of the Mexican Revolution. This was one of the big changes. It was a bloody time for about 15 years. And when they finally settled, the Mexicans adopted a constitution very similar to our constitution, almost verbatim, except it still had the Catholic Church as the official church for all of Mexico.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right, Bill, pick the story up from there. The Catholic Church is the official church of Mexico. Their constitution is very similar to ours, so go from there.
Matter of fact, the Miguel Hidalgo that started the revolution in Mexico gave the famous cry of Hidalgo, and he said, "Death to bad government and long live the Virgin of Guadalupe." And that was the cry that he gave, that he rallied the peasants, the poor, to rebel against the rich landowners and also Spain. And as they're marching toward Mexico City and they're winning several battles, this priest realizes that there's a lot of innocent Spaniards that are being killed by these peasants with their machetes, and it didn't turn out the way he thought, and he goes back to his town, and eventually he's caught and executed. But the revolution continues, and it's basically taken over by the wealthy landowners who decide they just simply wanted to rebel against Spain but continue to have a monarchy. And they wanted to have a monarchy, and they had a general, Iturbide, to put on the throne. They formed their constitution, but when Iturbi was killed is when Santa Anna took over. Santa Anna scrapped the constitution, and many of the Mexican states decided to rebel against Santa Anna. Chiapas, San Luis Potosi, and Texas, which of course is Texas. And Santa Anna went around killing and stamping out this revolution. I mean, he caught one time, several thousand Mexicans that were rebelling against him, and he just, killed them all. One time he conquered one of the towns that rebelled, and he told his soldiers they could rape and pillage for 48 hours. Not your George Washington type of leader by any stretch, but that's when he conquered, that's when the Mexicans, the people in Texas rebelled, and Santa Anna went up there, had the Alamo where he totally killed every single one of the 189 defenders. And then there was the Goliad, the only other army in the state, the country of Texas, because they were independent, they weren't a state yet, was coming out of Goliad, and Colonel Fannin was leading it, and Santa Anna's men captured them. And when they were in prison, they had surrendered. Well, Santa Anna decided that wasn't enough, so he took all 385 of these Texans out and had them executed. And that's when there was international outrage at Santa Anna, and that's when other countries decided to intervene, and that's how Texas got its independence. Santa Anna was eventually chased out, and he's led some revolutions in some of the other countries in Latin America. Mexico did come up with a constitution, which, as I mentioned, established the Catholic Church as the official church. In 1845 is when Texas joined the Union and became a state, and then the Mexicans began attacking Texas, and this time the United States decided to step in the picture, and we send our leaders down into Mexico to capture Mexico City.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Bill Federer. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and as Bill has told us the story of the Alamo, of Santa Anna, of his really ruthless position as far as anyone who opposed his rule, and of course eventually Santa Anna is defeated and driven out of Mexico, and so they're trying to establish a stable government in Mexico. America now at least has taken Texas on. Texas is going to become a state. So pick up the story there, Bill.
So Winfield Scott was a general, and Zachary Taylor, they went down to capture Mexico City. Robert E. Lee was the logistics staff, and he's the one that found the way to conquer Mexico City, so he gained valuable military knowledge during this time. And Mexico did sign the treaty with America in 1848, which in exchange for $15 million, we got California, Colorado, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, all those different states. And We came back, and Mexico did have somewhat of a stable government for a short time. Benito Juarez became the new leader, and he was one to try to help the masses of the poor, and the wealthy landowners decided to appeal to the French government over in France to send Maximilian to Mexico to be the emperor. And this poor guy, he landed in Mexico, and he didn't even know there was a revolution still going on. And he was going to be a very liberal leader and allow a lot of rights and freedoms to the people, but Benito Juarez didn't want an emperor, no matter how nice and liberal he was. And so he finally captured him and killed him.
Now, Chris, what year are we talking about, Bill?
1860s.
Okay, so this is the 1860s. Go ahead.
This is right around the time of the Civil War. Supposedly, Lincoln felt sorry for Benito Juarez fighting the French, and he had our American troops lose some supplies along the border for Juarez's troops to get, you know, to help him out, because he wasn't officially wanting to intervene. But there's a statue of Benito Juarez in Washington, D.C., right across from the Watergate building. And that's where Juarez, Mexico, was Ciudad Juarez was named after, City Juarez. But after Juarez died, a guy named Porfirio Diaz took over, and he's one who supported the ruling class, supported the wealthy, and supported the Catholic Church. When he was in office for 30 years, he got a lot of Americans to invest in the oil fields down there. He got foreign investment, but the poor didn't have their situation improved any. There wasn't the middle class. And finally, after 30 years, he staged another election, and he had himself unanimously elected, but it was so much staged, everybody knew it, so a guy named Madero takes over and has a revolt, challenges the election, and this is when things really fall apart, and Madero's men rob and steal and rape and pillage, and you know, Teddy Roosevelt wrote a book where he began to list all the different atrocities done by Madero's men, and there's one story where, you know, in some village in Texas, they come in there and they tell a lady to cook for them, they shoot her, and they make her get up and continue cooking while she's bleeding to death, and another little boy comes to the door, and they shoot him, and, you know, they're just ruthless band of you know, like MS-13 gang, you know. The Americans finally capture these Mexicans and put them in jail, but when things were breaking down, Madero became the new leader in Mexico, but his general was a guy named Huerta, H-E-U-R-T-A, and Huerta decided that he wanted to be a leader, and Madero offered him to be governor of one of the states of Chihuahua, but he didn't like that, and so he rebels and becomes the new leader, and he decides he's going to be an emperor dictator. Well, Woodrow Wilson decides to enter the picture and sends his boats down to protect the oil interests there in Tampico and around Veracruz, and there was an incident where his men were, some of the American soldiers were taken captive by Huerta's men, and finally they were let go, and he's about ready to pull out when there's the Zimmerman telegram, where the British intercept the telegram, there the Germans are trying to make a treaty with the Mexicans, sending them arms to fight the Americans. This is the beginning of World War One. So Woodrow Wilson decides to keep his troops down there and decides to back Carranza to overthrow Huerta. And Carranza is just as much of a bandito as Huerta is, and he had all kinds of raping and pillaging and killing. But nevertheless, the United States installs Carranza as the new leader of Mexico.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're getting a lesson in history, the history of Mexico, and so the United States now is actually installing the new leader, Carranza, in Mexico, and he's a bad guy, but he's a choice between two bad guys, so we choose one of the bad guys, and we began imposing our will on the Mexican people during the Woodrow Wilson administration. Pick the story up there, Bill.
So Pancho Villa was upset because he originally was with Carranza, but he split from Carranza, and so when we put in Carranza as the new leader in Mexico, Pancho Villa gets mad at America. And so he decides to lead all these raids across the border. Columbus, New Mexico, Pancho Villa's men, you know, storm it and attack it and kill dozens of people. Trains going through Mexico that had American citizens. Pancho Villa would stop the train and pull off the Americans and kill them and cut their heads off, and you know, hundreds of people. And Teddy Roosevelt writes in a book that I have, it's called Fear God and Take Your Own Part, and Teddy Roosevelt's criticizing Woodrow Wilson, and this is around 1915, 1916, and he talks about how the Mexicans would shoot across the border at Americans and kill hundreds. And that the American troops were instructed not to return fire. And so that there's reports of many of them that would refuse to re-enlist in the army because our government's policy was not to defend ourselves. And so they just, you know, town after town, city after city, they would just come across the border and kill whoever they wanted. And then in the south, there was a guy named Zapata, Emiliano Zapata, who led, the revolt, and, Woodrow Wilson finally sends General Blackjack Pershing, John J. Pershing. He got the name Blackjack because his first command was a Buffalo Brigade, the black soldiers, out in the western states. But Pershing, leads our troops into Mexico, about 30,000 down in there to capture Pancho Villa. Carranza, the, new leader in Mexico, refuses to let General Pershing used the railroads to ship supplies, and so his Pershing's got a real, you know, trouble of logistics moving supplies down there, and it goes on for a couple of years. Woodrow Wilson finally sends about 100,000 National Guardsmen to the border to help protect our border, Carranza decides to assassinate Zapata. And then
hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment for the last segment of the program. All right, this is Dr. Stan, and of course there's a lot of trouble down in Mexico. Woodrow Wilson eventually sends Blackjack Pershing, General Pershing, down into Mexico to capture the renegades down there. And is it Pancho Villa, or who are they going after this time?
Pershing went after Pancho Villa.
All right, so Blackjack Pershing, and this is in the time before America enters the First World War in 1917. So this must be 1914, 15, 16, somewhere in there?
Right, right.
Okay, pick up the story. So General Pershing is down there in Mexico, trying to pick up Pancho Villa, and of course the Mexican government isn't too happy to have the Americans down there, even though we're trying to get rid of the fellow who's embarrassing the Mexican government. Pancho Villa, of course, is attacking America because we're backing Carranza, who is a bad guy. So we got a choice between two bad guys. Now we're going after Pancho Villa. Go ahead.
And so the Mexican people hated Pancho Villa, but they hated hated the Americans more. We pull Pershing out. He didn't win, but he did harass Pancho Villa enough so that he lost his influence. And supposedly Pancho Villa, laid down his army and made a peace with Carranza and went back to his ranch. And somebody snuck onto his ranch and assassinated him. And probably under Carranza's order, but then Carranza ends up getting assassinated, and then after him, they have a new constitution in Mexico of the 1917 constitution, and this constitution was a backlash. It actually was the Masons supported the new constitution, which took away all land from the Catholic Church. Every church, every school, every seminary, every monastery, they lost the title to it, and the title belonged to the government. So the government of Mexico took all the land away. There are stories about how, you know, the Mexicans would go into churches and cathedrals and on their horses and knock down all the statues and take the hosts out and feed them to the horses and have orgies around the altar and take all the, you know, the sacred dishes and do all kinds of perverted things with them and rape the convents of nuns and kill the priests. In this new constitution, it forbade priests from going out in public. They couldn't, up until 1990, show you how recent, up until 1990, it was illegal for a priest in Mexico to go out in public in his priest's outfit because of this new 1917 constitution. They retaliated with such vengeance that this new constitution says that every church service had to be done under a government supervision, and that any and every church building, now this was particularly aimed at the Catholics, but it went into effect, so it was every church building, Protestant and Catholic. There was about 5% Protestant at the time. But even today, every church building belongs to the government. And finally, they had some legislation pushed through that basically churches could organize themselves as associations, and the association members were the church members, but the associations could own property. And so they found a way to get around their own constitution to allow just a semblance of religious freedom. But it was ruthless for years, no different than in France during the French Revolution when they had their attempt to destroy religion and specifically Christianity. So Mexico went through this terrible time of persecution. They went through different periods when it was on the books but they didn't enforce it, and then there's other times when it was on the books and they did enforce it. But even recently, when they've loosened up, about a couple years ago, a priest spoke at, the priests were forbidden to speak about anything political. As a matter of fact, any minister is forbidden in Mexico from saying anything about commenting on the politics. And there were some church leaders that did comment, and the government threatened them. And so it's still part of the rule in Mexico is that churches aren't supposed to speak out against anything political. But in relation to America, during Eisenhower's administration, we had illegal immigrants coming across, very small in number, but Eisenhower gave amnesty to those that came across in exchange for putting more tighter security on the border. And the security lasted for a couple of years, and then they sort of forgot about it. And then Kennedy noticed how the immigrants from poorer countries tended to be more dependent on the government and tended to vote Democrat. And so he changed the immigration policies. It was actually LBJ that signed Kennedy's plan into effect. So it was the 1965 immigration plan. One of the things I did a couple years ago was in New York for a convention, and I took two of my kids to Ellis Island, where they had brought all the immigrants into America. And in the big atrium area on the floor is a display, a big square, table type of thing, and on one side it had the dates, years, and on the other side it had where the immigrants were coming from. And so in the 1620s to 1640s and 80s, the immigrants to America, they had little cylinders that came up with different colors. They came from northern European countries, you know, England and Ireland and Scotland and so forth. In the early 1700s, they came from Central Europe. And then later they came from Southern Europe. And then later they came from Eastern Europe, you know, the Jews and so forth. And then they came from Africa, with all the slaves were brought over. And you can see these different columns rising up. And then around 1960, these columns rise up from Latin America, and they pass up all the other ones. And these are the ones that are from the Central American, Latin American countries. And underneath it has this little note that says, these are just the ones we're able to keep track of. And in the height of immigration through Ellis Island, you know, when the Irish came over and when the Italians came over, at the height there were 2,000 immigrants a day. 2,000 a day. Today there's over 10,000 a day coming across the border from Mexico. And so that was partially intentional from John F. Kennedy, because he knew that these poor people would be more dependent on the government and would secure the Democrats' hold on politics. But there still were not that many illegal aliens coming across. So during Ronald Reagan's era, there was an amnesty security thing where they gave amnesty to those that came across, and then they would, in exchange for tighter security. And that lasted for a couple years. But the big change happened under Clinton. Clinton pushed through NAFTA. And unfortunately, Republicans as well as the Democrats voted for NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And this did several things, one of which was to allow multinational companies to move into Mexico. So the Walmarts began to move down there and open up their Walmart stores and supply goods made in China cheaper than the little Mexican stores could manufacture those items. And so it put tens of thousands of Mexican business people out of work. And then the NAFTA allowed for U.S. subsidized grain to go into Mexico. You know, the ConAgras and all these big and they can grow grain cheaper, you know, with their big combines and so forth than the little Mexican peasant can on his subsistence farm and his little cow. And so they would move in and put these little Mexican farmers out of work.
And of course, the other thing is we were shipping in subsidized corn. We subsidized growing of corn in America. Now we can ship it in there. We can undersell the poor Mexican farmer. And now they were poor before, but now they're really poor.
And so the government in Mexico began to suffer and lose investments, and so Mexico decided to try to keep investments. They would devalue the peso. So that meant that for every American dollar, you could now buy twice as many pesos. You know. And so these poor Mexicans with their little pesos realized that they could buy half of what they could buy before. So not only did they have less manufacturing and less farms, their pesos were cut in half, and then the... part of NAFTA allowed the maquiladores, these free trade zone areas in Mexico where the Americans, you know, the foreigners would build the factories, and the Mexicans would come up, mostly from the south, Chiapas and Yucatan, those were the poor, poor areas, and the little farmers would come up to work in these factories. Well, they only lasted for about a year and a half until the business owners realized they could make stuff cheaper in China, and so they shut them down. They're just about all shut down now. Well, once these people had transplanted, they decided, heck, let's go ahead and make a run for America. And so we basically caused the immigration mess through NAFTA, which brings up a whole other part of the equation, is there's schizophrenia in the Republican ranks, where you have the grassroots Republicans saying, secure the borders, protect our property. You know, the Constitution says the government's supposed to provide for the common defense. And then anybody can go on Wikipedia and type in trade blocks, and it pulls up all the global regional trade organizations. It has the EU in there. It has a little map where it colors in all of Europe as one color. And then it has basically the EU of African states and the EU of the Southeast Asian countries. And I'm saying EU, but I mean they're the union between these different ones. And of course, there's the NAFTA. It was the North American Free Trade Agreement. And it has America, Canada, and Mexico all colored in with one color. And then it has a graph at the bottom, and again, this is the Wikipedia website, and it has columns. And the first column says travel without a visa. Another column says common currency and currency exchange. Another column says, you know, the trade agreements and pacts. Another column says borderless. And in Europe, it says, you know, accomplished and everything. But in the other ones, it has proposed and proposed and proposed, and then, you know... and so you can clearly see that part of their goal for having these regional trade blocks is to have it be borderless. And of course, it's all part of a global plan. And the people that, and unfortunately, it's human nature that's driving the thing, is that, you know, we want everything cheaper. And the way to make it cheaper is you allow businesses to make their manufacturing factories in areas where there's the cheapest labor so they can move the stuff around and so forth. But it's the financial bottom line that's driving the globalization, but the globalization is what's pushing through NAFTA, and NAFTA is what put all these small Mexican farmers out of business, which is the result of flooding our borders with immigration.
But don't you really think, Bill, that there is an agenda? They want to do away with the sovereignty of America and merges with Mexico, and then CAFTA would merges with Central America, and the FTAA would merges with South America, which probably isn't going to happen. But certainly they really want to do away with national sovereignty. Isn't that really what globalism is really about?
Yeah, and it's that's why there's a schizophrenia there, because you have... you know, the grassroots conservatives saying, you know, look, you know, protect our border, and you have the rich internationalists, and whether they're Democrat or Republican, their loyalty is to the bottom line financially, you know, they're the ones pushing for the getting rid of the borders so they can have factories where the labor is the cheapest.
But you know what's really so amazing about the Senate legislation is that was certainly not a Republican piece of legislation. That was the Democratic legislation. You know, you see 63, 64 votes. That was all but four Democratic senators voted in favor of that. And on the other side were 36 steadfast Republicans, or at least 32 steadfast Republicans, and four Democrats. This was Ted Kennedy's bill that George Bush was pushing. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, why would the President of the United States, they talk about bipartisan, this wasn't bipartisan. You got Bill Frist and, you know, a handful of Republicans who want it, and all the rest of Republican senators are opposing it. It's the Democrats that want it, and yet, of course, what this is going to do is hurt the working man. Giving, you know, certainly citizenship to all these people who have come into our country illegally and broken our laws, you would think the Democrats would be opposing it. Instead of that, they're supporting it. And the Republicans, you know, are really opposing what's going on. But we don't hear about that. We hear this is the Republicans. It's really not the Republicans. It's this is a Democrat piece of legislation. It's Ted Kennedy's legislation. And George Bush is pushing it.
Yeah, it's a real change that most people don't realize, that you have... you have the grassroots Republicans together with the Union Democrats that are against the allowing of the illegal immigrants to come over, and then you have the wealthy Republicans with the wealthy Democrats who are, you know, the multinational companies. Basically, it's to them they want to bet on every horse in the race, and so whoever gets elected, whether they're Democrat or Republican or whatever, they're indebted to them. And today, to run for the Senate, you know, it's 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 million dollars to run. Well, how can one person raise $30 million? Well, you need to go to the people that have the money to be able to run, and so you're indebted to them. And so that's why it used to be at the beginning of our country that U.S. senators were elected by the state government.
And I bet if that was put up to a vote right now, the American people would vote for that. But, of course, it's never going to come to a vote because the elite want to be able to buy and sell the senators, and that's just what they do. We got the finest politicians in Washington, D.C. that money could buy.
And one other interesting part of the equation, Dr. Stan, is that the number one source of income for the nation of Mexico is not oil, it's not exports. The number one source of income is money sent back from immigrants. So they call it remittances. And so there's no motivation for Vicente Fox to want to cut down on immigration, because the people go across the border and they send the money back to the country, and it's the number one source. And so it's actually a triple whammy on America, because not only do the illegal immigrants use the free services from public schools to Medicare to signing up for Social Security to you know, the transportation, the court systems, because so many of them, you know, there's lots of crime, but when they set up their businesses, they have an underground economy. So for example, in Los Angeles, if you get a dent in your car and you take it to a regular car repair place, you have to pay the prevailing union wages, and it's very expensive. But if you take it to a little barrio, you can get a good job done for very cheap. And so it's taking business away from the businesses that pay the taxes. And so there's fewer people paying into the system. And then the third part of it is they're sending the money back to Mexico rather than reinvesting and spending that money in America to help other businesses in America. So it's a big drain, you know, almost like a parasitic type drain on the economy, and there's no immediate answer other than we need to crack down on it. One of the things I talk about, and I've probably done on your show before, is the fall of the Roman Empire, and how Rome in its final stages was being overrun with illegal immigrants. a lot of them were our ancestors, you know, the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths and Angles and Saxons and Jutes and Lombards. They didn't cross the Rio Grande, they crossed the Rhine River Valley. And when they first began to cross, they would assimilate and learn the Latin language, but then and learn respect for appreciation for the Roman Republican form of government. Even though they had an emperor, they still had the senators, and they still had, you know, local Republican representative government. But then they began coming across so many and so fast that they didn't assimilate, they didn't learn the Latin language, they kept their own languages and sort of made a Tex-Mex mix. You know, they'd mix German and Latin and English and Latin and French and Latin. That's why they call those languages the Romantic languages, because they have a little bit of the Roman Latin mixed in, but they're their own language.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Bill Federer right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and before you go on, Bill, let's go ahead and get your website out where people can know how they can get in touch with you. I know we carry a number of Bill's books, but I'm sure Bill has a lot of books we probably don't carry yet, probably will before long, but why don't you get your website out and how people get in touch with your ministry?
Oh, thanks, Dr. Stan. Well, my website is AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com, and I even sent out a free daily email that anybody can sign up for, call the American Minute there. And then I have a toll-free number. It's 1-888-USA-WORD, 1-888-USA-WORD. And one thing I thought was interesting in reading through the history of Mexico was it made me appreciate George Washington. I mean, here's a general, George Washington, that conquered the most powerful military in the world, and his response was, once we won, to resign. And he handed in his resignation and went back to farming at Mount Vernon. And you contrast that with Madero and Huerta and Pancho Villa and, you know, all these different generals in Mexico where, the you know, one would kill the other and take over, and then another one would kill him and take over. And it's like they were all very greedy. And, you know, it made me appreciate William Penn. I mean, William Penn was a landowner. The entire state of Pennsylvania was his personal property. And what did he do? He let everybody live on it for free. He didn't try to make a killing. You know, Lord Baltimore, who was given Delaware as his own, Maryland as his own proprietary state. It was his personal property. He went ahead and let people move in there for free. Where in Mexico, the landowners, they kept control of their land and their property. And they made, you know, the people and the immigrants work on it. You know, they couldn't own the land. They were sharecroppers down in the Yucatan Chiapas area. They had what they call ejidos. I'm not pronouncing exactly right, but this was land that was owned by the landowners and later owned by the government, but all the peasants were allowed to farm it. And just recently, under the, you know, current administration, they pressured the government of Mexico to change this century-old practice to allow the government to sell that common land to multinational corporations for their big grain operations. Again, another step to put the poor little farmers out of business.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program with our good friend Bill Federer. And, of course, if you have not yet read his book, America's God and Country, we carry it. You must have it. I keep it by my side at all the times. Well, Bill, we're out of time. I know we could go on, but certainly Bill is simply pointing out that in Mexico, you know, they have a ruling class, a small group of people, a small group of very wealthy people. Now they're making agreements with the multinational corporations to give the land to them, and the poor people become poor. My fear is that we're seeing the same thing here in America, and I think we will see increasingly as a result of NAFTA and as a result of the World Trade Organization, as a result of globalization and the plan program to send American jobs and American factories out of this country, we will, instead of moving towards increasing the prosperity of our people, move increasingly towards a divided society, a very rich and a very poor, very similar to what they have in Mexico today. What do you think about that, Bill?
Well, you know, Phyllis Schlafly, and she has a website, eagleforum.org. her newsletter back in, I think, May or June of last year, she documents the global treaties and the Council on Foreign Relations and how the goal is to have America be assimilated with Mexico and Canada. And, you know, since NAFTA, the standard of living of the average Mexican has gone down, but in Mexico, they have 50 more billionaires than they had before. So, in other words, the extremely wealthy are getting extremely more wealthy, and the poor are not being aided at all by these international treaties. It's not in America where there was this effort for middle class. But as globalization takes place, it helps the large corporations. Yeah. I talked to a person in Europe, and they said when Czechoslovakia joined the EU, the next day 600 cheesemakers were put out of business because the EU has phone books worth of regulations on how to make cheese, and the way they had been making cheese in their little mom-and-pop shops for hundreds of years didn't meet the code.
Well, I think I really fear that the same thing is going to happen here in America. We're out of time, Bill. We could go on, but I'm looking forward to have you back again next week on our other programs. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan.
And one more time, get your website out there for our listeners.
It's AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. And toll-free telephone number is 888-USA-WORD, 888-USA-WORD. And you can not only buy my books, which is a great help to me when people do buy them, but you can sign up for my daily email called the American Minute, short little historical vignette of what happened on East State in American history. So it's AmericanMinute.com.
Good night. God bless. Bye-bye, Bill. All right, fine. That was Bill Federer. I always enjoy having him. I hope you did, too. A wonderful lesson in history. Of course, this is the time I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We depend upon you to help us. And if you're out there in the listening audience and would like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get Bill's books, America's God and Country, and available both in book and in DVD, his book on there really is a St. Nicholas, his book on George Washington Carver, his book on St. Patrick. We carry all of them. We think they're excellent. And then if you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, goes into the background of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged. If you haven't got our four tapes out on immigration or the DVD we carry entitled The Conquest of Aztlan, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for Radio Liberty. Pray for our provision and our protection. And so until we're together again, may the Lord be with you.